Thanks, Brad. Okay, good evening, everyone. It's good to see you, good to be here. Let me take some time just to introduce myself so I'm not quite so anonymous to you. My name is Steve Timmis, and I've been happily married to Janet for 29 years. We've got four children who are all married, and they're lovely children, and they've got lovely husbands and wives. We're also very thankful grandparents to two most excellent grandchildren, Oliver and Noah. I promised them I'd give them a mention tonight, so I've got their name there. I don't know what else might be useful for you to know. I'm a carnivorous vegetarian. Maybe that'll help. I'm an evolutionary creationist, a charismatic cessationist, and a post-trib, post-rapture panmillennialist. So if any of those mean anything to you, you've managed to put me in a box, so feel free to do that. I come from England, where English was invented, as was football. And what I mean by that is a game that is played with a spherical object, a ball, and where you actually kick it. So that's why it's called football. I live in the northern city of Sheffield, a city of some 550,000 people, and I'm leading a church planting network called the 215 Network, and 215 is taken from Ezra 2:15. So if you want to know why the significance of that, do look up that passage. And we're part of the Crowded House. I also help lead the Porterbrook Network, and I lead that with my friend and co-author of Total Church, Tim Chester. And that is a church planting and missional church training program. So those are the things that kind of will place me, give you some idea of who I am. And I guess this is a bit, might be one of those mandatory comments, but it is genuinely true. The most important thing for me, as for any of us here this evening, is that I'm a forgiven sinner who, by grace, has got his name written in the Lamb's Book of Life. And that's what we rejoice in. That genuinely is what where our identity should be found. Jesus, when the disciples came back to him, were rejoicing that the demons were subject to them. And he said, don't rejoice that, rejoice that your names are written in heaven. So having got those few details out of the way, let me try and tell you about how we're going to handle this evening. This first session is going to be mainly teaching, but the next two sessions are going to be more limited teaching and more nailed down practical how-to kind of teaching. With plenty of time for questions. So it's up to you to set the agenda with those questions. I want this to be as practical as possible and as helpful as possible on this whole issue of gospel communities, because that's what I'm here to talk about. But as I say, this first session is really trying to establish the principles. And I think it's important to do that for a number of reasons. And I think that the main reason is that if we don't do that, if we fail to take the time to establish the principles and be clear about what we're trying to do, then we'll find that when we start trying to build these gospel communities, that actually they're not gospel communities at all. And not only are they not gospel communities, but because the gospel isn't at the very center of them, they're not going to actually be communities. For gospel communities to be gospel communities, you need both the gospel and community. That sounds quite obvious, doesn't it? And the great thing about it is that most of what I'm going to say tonight is quite obvious. This is a reproducible model. This is something that you can take and you can apply in whatever situation you are. You don't need any gurus standing at the front basically telling you how to do it or holding your hand as you go through the process. What I want to do is to, as I say, get the principle established and work out the practice in a way that's going to be helpful to you. The first issue then is the central thesis. The central thesis of our book, Total Church, is that Christians are called to a dual fidelity, a faithfulness to the gospel word and a faithfulness to the gospel community. That's so very important. And the thing about this is that it's never an either-or situation. It's always a both-and situation. It's like love and marriage in the old song. They just go together. It's like Tamla and Motown. They belong together. It's like Jack Bauer and extreme but justifiable violence. They're just there. You can't separate the two. Gospel and community are hand in hand. They're the Siamese twins of the biblical story. So the former, the gospel word, creates the latter, the gospel community, and the latter, the gospel community, demonstrates the power of the former, the gospel word. So what I want to do now is just to look at the whole issue of the gospel and unpack it for us as best we can. And I want to give you the gospel in summary form. And there it is. Jesus, God's promised rescuer and ruler, lived our life, died our death, and rose again in triumphant vindication as the first fruits of the new creation to bring forgiven sinners together under his gracious rule. Now, obviously, that isn't meant to summarize what the gospel is about in all of its glory. God took a whole book called the Bible to tell us the gospel. 66 books, beginning in Genesis 1, going all the way through to Revelation 22. But what that's trying to do, and the New Testament gives us lots of examples of gospels in a nutshell, that's just trying to say this is the gospel in a nutshell. And this is trying to encapsulate the main ingredients. And I think this is very important when we're talking about gospel communities, because this is a gospel that defines those communities. This is a gospel that gives shape to those communities. That this is the gospel that will actually determine what kind of community you have. To the extent that you believe this gospel, to the extent that you live consistently with this gospel, that will determine the nature of your communities. But the gospel is at the very heart of gospel communities. So what I want to do is just unpack this gospel summary to show you how all the elements in some way play into and inform the nature of the communities that we're talking about and why we talk about communities, gospel communities, and why they're so important for us to be faithful as the people of God in this generation. So the first one that we're going to look at is Jesus. If we can just get that gospel definition up on the screen again, then people can refer to that as I'm going through it. So Jesus. I don't know if you've noticed, and I hope this is true in your churches and in your experience, but we tend to use the name Jesus quite a lot. It's right that we do that. We probably don't use it as much as your next-door neighbor who drives a 4x4, but we still use the name Jesus a lot, and we really should do. But the big question is, what do we mean when we use the term Jesus? What does our neighbor mean when he uses the term Jesus? We need to know that, but what do we mean? And that's equally as important, because for a lot of people, the name Jesus conjures up all sorts of images. For a lot of people, he's a dress-wearing white guy. Who suffers from anemia and alopecia. I spent some time in an art gallery in Brussels, we spent the just recently with my wife, and we were in the Renaissance art section, and it was some phenomenal art. It was incredible, but the most disturbing thing about it were their presentations of Jesus. In that he really was this anemic-looking man with alopecia. He couldn't grow a beard. You looked at him and you just thought, I really don't want to worship that Jesus. I'm not drawn to that Jesus. Let me just tell you about one painting by a Renaissance artist of the 14th century. It was this picture, and there were five characters in it. There was a supplicant called Peter who was kneeling down. And he was praying. And the other character, another character, was Jesus on the cross. And we'll come back to him. But to the shoulder of this supplicant called Peter was Saint Peter. And he was a patron saint of this supplicant. So Peter, the supplicant, was praying to his patron saint, who then spoke to John, the Apostle John, who was the other side of the cross, because who then spoke to Mary, who then spoke to Jesus on the cross. And that was the way the whole kind of theology worked. And it was fascinating. He had to speak to his patron saint, who had to persuade John, to persuade Mary, to persuade Jesus. The problem was, Jesus looked completely disinterested. He was kind of hanging there on the cross, obviously thinking about other things. Yeah, I've got more important things to do than answer prayer. I've got more important things to do than save a world. But he just kind of looked a bit kind of spaced out on that cross. And there was nothing that moved you as you looked at it apart from profound sadness. The strongest character was Mary. You know, she was somebody who you were drawn to. And that was clearly the intention of the artist. But Jesus isn't like that. Not the Jesus that we know, not the Jesus that we worship, not the Jesus that the Bible speaks about. And Jesus, the name Jesus, isn't a free-floating term that can mean whatever we want it to mean. It's a name that has content and substance. And that content and substance is given to us from the Old Testament. So that's why the next clause of it is Jesus, God's promised rescuer and ruler. Now, I find it helps to do a bit of reverse translation when I'm reading the New Testament. This is a tip that I'm going to give to you. And it's really quite helpful that whenever I come across the word Christ, I replace it in my mind by the word Messiah. Because Christ is a Greek translation of the Hebrew term Messiah. And it's actually really very helpful to do that, because that then takes me back into the Hebrew Scriptures, into the Old Testament. And that inhibits me from actually thinking about Christ as a surname rather than a title. Because that's how we do think of it, isn't it? So Steve Timmis, Jesus Christ. That's his surname. But it's not his surname, it's his title. He is the Christ. He is the Messiah. And because he was the Messiah, we then know something very significant about this Jesus. That is, he is the one who was promised by Yahweh to come to rescue his people, to bring his people out of exile, and to lead them into the promises of God where they would live under his rule. That's who the Messiah was. So whenever the term Messiah was used, that was the image, those were the images that were conjured in the minds of the people listening. And it was a glorious term, and it was a glorious title. And that is a Jesus, you see, who towers over history. That anemic-looking white Jesus on the cross in that Renaissance painting doesn't tower over history. He didn't even dominate the canvas. But this Jesus, who is promised by God to rescue his people, to bring them out of exile, and to bring them into the promises of God, now that is a Jesus that you want to do business with, isn't he? He's a Jesus with attitude. He's a Jesus with presence. He's a Jesus who's got what it takes to get the work done. And this is the Jesus that we're called to honor and bow before and kiss in homage and submission, lest he becomes angry and destroys us in his way, as Psalm 2 describes him. Now, look, please don't misunderstand me. I'm not talking here about a macho Jesus with bulging muscles and denim dungarees. That's as much an invention of our culture as that image of that Jesus on the cross was of the Renaissance culture. But I'm arguing for a Jesus that demands respect and demands attention and allegiance and honor and pure, unadulterated awe. That's the Jesus that we're talking about. Now, why am I laboring this point? Aren't we here to be talking about gospel communities, to be trained in that in some way? Well, I'm arguing for it because we've got a problem when we're talking about forming and nurturing gospel-centered communities. And the problem is this word community. It's a bit of an anemic term, just as Jesus, as considered by many people, is a bit of an anemic Jesus. It's a touchy-feely word. Do you use that phrase over here, touchy-feely? Yeah? Well, it is a touchy-feely word, isn't it? It's a kind of thing that women get excited about. Or men who are in touch with their feminine side. But you don't really want real men to get excited by community. You know, so, dear, can we go and join a community? Ah, give me a beer. That kind of stuff. You know, it's just not what they're going to really be turned on by at all. So, because of that, then when we hear community and we talk about community, community is often understood as being full of touchy-feely activities. So it's a time for deep sharing, and it's a time for intense counseling, or it's a time for an exploration of our emotions, or pursuing one another just to see, how are you doing? So community can easily degenerate into basically some kind of love-in, where I get to explore my inner child. And as my ego is massaged by attentive therapists and fellow addicts. And it's just an excuse for self-worship. And there's a lot of people who are interested in community who really want that kind of community. But that's not the kind of community that I'm talking about. The Renaissance Jesus would have supported, he'd have loved that kind of community. But the biblical Jesus, that's not his kind of thing at all. The biblical Jesus, who's God's promised rescuer and ruler, this is a Jesus who demands something other. In the United Kingdom, we had an advertising campaign for a bar of chocolate called Yorkie. And the tagline of it was, Yorkie, it's not for girls. I was surprised they got away with it. But I understood it was kind of that reverse psychology, because a lot of girls bought it just to show that it was for them. So they were standing there and in their Doc Martens saying, look, I can't eat a whole Yorkie bar. It was a great advertising campaign. But if you can catch the subtlety of this, and I know you're American, but if you can catch the subtlety... that was a cheap shot, wasn't it? I mean, it really was. Like, how are you going to come back at me with that one? Pardon? I missed that. I'm sorry. Whoever you are, wherever you are, just see me after. Okay. But our gospel communities, they're not for girls. I'm not saying they're not for women, but they're not for girls, they're not for girlies, they're not for people who just want to do this loving thing. They're for people who want to take Jesus, this biblical Jesus, towering over history, who want to take him seriously. So, Jesus, God's promised rescuer and ruler, lived our life and died our death. Now, this is a vitally important aspect of the gospel and therefore of our gospel communities, for the simple reason that it points to a Jesus who succeeded where we failed and where the whole of the nation Israel failed. That this Jesus who came to live the life that Israel was called to live but failed to live, he came to live the life that we were called to live as human beings but we failed to live. And it points to a Jesus who really did get the job done. It points to a Jesus who was tempted in every way as we are, and yet without sin. And do you know what that means? That means that Jesus endured temptation like you and I have never, ever endured temptation. Because Satan would have just kept throwing it at him, determined to just pull the rug from under his feet, determined for him to fall flat on his face. But Jesus, in his humanity, withstood it. And it was relentless, the opposition to him. How do we know that? Well, we know that because look what happened in those 40 days after his baptism. That he was so worn out as a result of the temptations that the angels came and ministered to him. And then that turning point in the Gospel of Mark, when Simon Peter said, after Jesus said he was going to the cross, Simon Peter said, no, Lord, that's not going to happen to you. And he turned on him and he said, get behind me, Satan. And then in the Garden of Gethsemane, where he just sweat blood at the prospect of what was waiting him. How intense a pressure to move away from his father's purposes for him. But whatever Satan threw at him, Jesus stood firm. He stood where we fell. He stood where the whole of Israel had fallen. He stood where Adam had fallen. And he endured a death so terrible that not even, the Romans weren't even meant to mention it among themselves. And that was merely the physical aspect. Because under the cloak of darkness, this Jesus, this towering, awesome, biblical Jesus, God's rescuer and ruler, under the cloak of darkness, he drank the cup of God's wrath to the very last dregs. As the Father poured out his wrath upon him. And he treated him as though he was the worst sinner that had ever lived. This is the Jesus that we worship. This is the Jesus who's our substitute. He lived our life and he died our death. He stood in the place of sinners and of rebels and as failures. And this is the Jesus who did this work that is the focus of our communities. He's the focus of the gospel. He's got to be the focus of our gospel-centered communities. And this is the gospel that has got to be at the heart of those gospel-centered communities. And can you see the kind of community that is going to be created by that kind of gospel? It's going to be characterized by humility, it's going to be characterized by thankfulness, and it's going to be characterized by grace. Humility, first of all, it's a community that's full of men and women who know that they're failures. Do you know how liberating that is? Do you know how tiring it is to actually live your life under this pretense that somehow you're a successful person? You have to perform all the time. You have to impress people all the time. You want people to think well of you. But what does the gospel say? This Jesus, God's promised rescuer and ruler who lived our life and died our death. It says, no, you're a failure. You're a community of failures. For all of your efforts, for all of your works, for all of your posturing, we stand naked and exposed before a holy God. So we labored under this delusion of being the bee's knees. We labored under this delusion of being some big man. We labored under this delusion that we're in with the in crowd and that we're somebody. And then Jesus comes along, the Messiah, and he says, look, I've got news for you. You're none of those things. You're a failure, a nothing, and a nobody. But here's the good news. I've come to do something about it. Now, what a great impact that would have on our communities, wouldn't it? If we really believe that, it would have a phenomenal impact. Because how much would that, how would we relate to one another? We'd relate to one another, finding it easy to actually prefer one another, to think more highly of others than we do of ourselves. I've got a confession to make to you. I feel that we know each other well enough now. We've had a bit of dialogue going on. with some rude person over there. But here's my confession. I used to really struggle with criticism. It really used to bother me. I didn't like it when people didn't like me. I didn't like it when people didn't like the things that I did or said. Or when they questioned my motives. And I've had a number of experiences where people have challenged me, have criticized me quite harshly, and I've reacted really quite badly to it in the past. And it's been an issue for me. But as I came to understand the gospel more and understood this, the nature of this gospel, that, yeah, the gospel says that I'm a failure. The bad news is that I'm a sinful failure and a rebel before a holy God. And then the good news is that Jesus has done something about it. When I believe that, then when people criticize me now because of the things that I do or the things that I say, I just have to put up my hand and say, look, you're criticizing me for what you know, but boy, if you knew what was really going on inside here, then you'd have something to criticize. Then you'd have somebody, that would be a case to get onto, I could promise you. Because I just don't need, the pressure isn't on me now to present myself as being something that I'm not. But that's only possible because the gospel is convincing me moment by moment that outside of Christ I'm nothing. In Christ, I'm a forgiven sinner whose name is written in the Lamb's Book of Life. What better is there than that? And that means that I can be in community where we can live up close and personal and people can relate to me as a human being. And I don't need to perform for them and they don't need to perform for me. And that means also, therefore, that it's thankfulness. This gospel makes me thankful. I mean, gloriously thankful, because there's a lightness and an attractiveness, isn't there, about someone who is thankful. You know, they may not go around with a smile on their face, but they do go around with something of a bit of a spring in their step. There's just this sense of profound thankfulness because they know that everything that they have has been given to them. Everything that they are is because God has worked it in them. That's what Paul says in Ephesians 2, isn't it? You've been saved by grace, faith through grace, not of yourselves, but of God. And what does he go on to say? Well, even the good works that that we do have been prepared for in advance by God. So I'm saved by grace, praise God for that. I bring nothing to the cross. But then even when I'm the other side, this side of the cross, then I still can't take any credit for what I do because God's prepared those works for me to do. And he says to the Philippians, look, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling because it is God who works in you to will and to choose for his good purpose. So it's all of God, it's all of grace, it's all of his mercy, it's all because of what Jesus has done. And that's going to make me thankful, and that's going to make my community a thankful community. We're not going to whinge, we're not going to grumble, we're not going to complain, we're going to be thankful. I was reminded last night about a joke that Australians say about Brits. I mean, it's completely untrue. It's prejudice and bigotry, but I'll tell you because it's an interesting one. How do the Australians know when the BA flight from London has landed at Sydney Airport? Because the whining continues when the engines are turned off. Whining is a bit of a cultural pastime for us, it has to be admitted. But it often is for Christians. But this gospel means that we don't have to whine. We don't have to grumble and complain because we should be a thankful people. And a community characterized by thankfulness would be a sweet community, wouldn't it? And grace is the third element. See, the gospel, the law of dynamic reproducibility says that grace produces grace. Life replicates itself. It can't be any other way. And the more that we understand that Jesus the Messiah lived our life and died our death, the more that grace is going to characterize my life and the life of my community. So our communities won't be places of performance, they won't be places of achievement or places of earned respect. There'll be places where there's a level ground where everybody can stand, where we'll love one another, prefer one another, look out for the interest of each other rather than our own interests. There'll be communities where we welcome the rejects and the marginalized and the outcasts and the sinners and the untouchable for the simple reason that they're full of people who know that apart from grace, that's exactly who they are. And there, but for the grace of God now, that's what they would become again. It is a fact of life, isn't it? It's not just a fact of my life. I know it's a fact of all of our lives. We screw up from time to time. Well, let me tell you this. The gospel of Jesus Christ, God's ruler, a rescuer and ruler who lived our life and died our death, creates communities where there is no better place to be for people who screw up and who are screw-ups. If you have screwed up in your life and you are a screw-up, then that's where you want to be, I can tell you. And wouldn't it be sweet if that were the case? Rather than, you know, churches so often can be places where people just, I don't know, just get on one of those cases so easily and just weigh people down with expectations. Sometimes churches are the last place that you'd want people to know that you're a sinner. Oh yeah, we say we're sinners. Of course we acknowledge that. But in terms of our specific sin, we're going to keep those hidden away. But in a community that is infused, created, sustained, nurtured by this gospel, then we can bring our sin and we can say, look, this is who I am. This is what I did. Brothers and sisters, pray for me, minister to me, forgive me, nurture me, disciple me. So Jesus, God's promised rescuer and ruler, lived our life, died our death, and rose again in triumphant vindication. See, to the gaze of the onlooker, the death of Jesus was his final curtain call. When he said, "It is finished," and gave up his spirit, as it were, to the casual observer looking on at this gruesome scene, he was at best a noble loser. Noble, certainly, but a loser nonetheless. For his executioners, it was a sigh of relief, a long overdue adios to a pain in their collective derriere, if you'll pardon my French. But the resurrection kicked both that sympathy and that bigotry into touch. And the resurrection was the father putting his arms around his son and saying, "That's my boy. This is who he is. Come on, everybody, have a look at him. He's not who you thought he was, is he? This isn't the one that you're wishing now that you hadn't rejected him, don't you?" Jesus, the conqueror of death, the final enemy. Eat your heart out, Jack. This is what you call a savior. This is a real savior. Rose again in triumphant vindication as the first fruits of the new creation. The resurrection wasn't simply a personal victory for Jesus so that he could go smugly into heaven. It was a pledge of a new world to come. It was, in fact, an irrefutable and irresistible intrusion of the new world that marked the beginning of the end of the old one. And in this new world, Jesus is saying, there is no sin. It's been dealt with. There is no death. It's been conquered. This is life, Jim, but not as we know it. This is a glorious life. This is a new life. This is resurrection life. This is a whole new creation. This isn't just about rescuing your soul and getting you as an individual up to heaven. This is God's big story, big picture, where he's bringing the whole of creation into what it should be, where he's satisfying the groanings of creation. And it's saying, look, this is what you've been waiting for. To bring forgiven sinners together under his gracious rule, under his gracious reign. This new creation didn't disappear with Jesus when he went back to heaven. It was from that exalted position that the risen, ascended Jesus sent the Holy Spirit to set apart a people for the Messiah by applying all that he did upon the cross to sinners and to form them into a new community over which he, as the king, would rule. And they would be an inbreaking of this new world. They would be a foretaste of this new creation. And it's in these gospel communities created by the Spirit as he applies the finished work of Christ, it's in these gospel communities that the fruit of the Messiah's work is put on display for the whole world to see. Who is Jesus? Look at his church. What is this new age, this new creation? Well, then look at the church, the outpost of eternity. These gospel communities, these churches that we're talking about, that is community, genuine community that is formed by the gospel, is the gospel apologetic. It's what the world looks at and says, we can't understand this, and it's only the gospel word that explains it. It's in these gospel communities that we live, by the power of the Holy Spirit, something of the age to come. When Paul was writing to Timothy, his sidekick, and he was actually struggling to get some churches back on a gospel track in the city of Ephesus, this is how he describes the church in chapter 3. He describes it as a household of God, the church of the living God, the pillar and the buttress of the truth. Now that's a truly awesome description of these gospel communities and what God intended them to be. The pillar and support of the truth. The word support that is used by Paul there in 1 Timothy 3:15 describes the truth that the church keeps the gospel steady. And it's an interesting inversion there. But the church is where the gospel truth is actually rehearsed and where it's celebrated and it's proclaimed. It's built upon the gospel and it sustains the gospel by her life together. The pillar is what holds the roof in place. And in the city of Ephesus, there was a temple of Diana or Artemis. And it was a splendid temple that was where the roof was held in place by some 50-foot pillars. Now, what Paul is saying here is, look, church, you don't need no edifice because the church is a household of God that needs no bricks and mortar. It's your life together that puts the gospel on display. It's your life together that makes you stand out in the world around you. It's your life together lived out in these communities, shoulder to shoulder, eyeball to eyeball, the way we see the gospel transforming you so that the world knows that we elevate the truth and put it on display. So, that's the gospel. Now the question is, can you see what this gospel does? It defines the gospel word, which gives specific shape to the gospel communities that we need to form. And without this gospel word at the very center, then our gospel communities are going to be nothing more than self-help groups. They're going to be nothing more than special interest groups or therapy groups or cool places for the chic and the beautiful or the geeks and the wannabes. That's what they're going to be, but they're not going to be gospel communities. But with this, our communities are going to be previews of eternity. See, if people's experience of church is only, and please hear me on this one, if it is only a gathering, an event where lots of people come together and sing songs and listen to teaching and say prayers and drink coffee and then disperse, if that's what they see, then they're not getting any insight into what the future is. They're not getting any real insight into what that gospel word produced. Oh, they're going to hear it preached. They're going to hear it taught well, but they're not going to get any insight. They're not going to understand it. They're not going to be able to see it with flesh and bone. But here in these communities formed by the gospel, then they're going to see this glimpse of eternity. Oh, it's going to be blurred for sure because the best gospel community is going to be imperfect. But by grace, it's going to be with enough definition for people to see and say, I want some of that. I really do. They're going to glimpse the glory of God in the face of Jesus as it radiates among his people. Now, in our next session, we're going to get down to the nitty-gritty and just talk about how it can work out in practice. But I just got a couple of things to say as I finish. First of all, please don't think that community that I'm going to be talking about is an optional extra. We're called to this dual fidelity to the gospel word and the gospel story. You read the Bible and you see it is all about community. There in the Garden of Eden, what was God doing with Adam and Eve? But he was establishing a community. He wanted a people. Adam alone couldn't bear the image of God. It needed a community to bear the image of a God. Why? Because it is a God in community who we come to know as Father, Son, and Spirit. So it needed people in community, individuals in community, to model him and image him. But then they blew it, and so God then, in his divine purposes, called Israel into being. And what was the purpose of Israel? That she would be a community. A community that would be standout kind of community in the world, that the world would look at and see and say, now we know what God is like. But Israel blew it. And who came along but Jesus? Jesus, the true Son of God. Adam, the Son of God, failed. Israel, the Son of God, failed. Jesus, the Son of God, succeeded. But what did he do? What was the first thing he did as he came preaching the arrival of the kingdom of God? He called people to follow him and he formed a community. And he said, okay, when I go, you've got the task. And how are you going to fulfill this mandate? How are you going to fulfill this mission? You're going to fulfill it by planting communities all over the world, littering the world with communities of light. And they're going to be outposts of eternity because they're going to point right out to the new heaven and new earth. And what is that but a new Jerusalem? And what is that but a community with the cross at the very center of it, living in the light of the glory of God? So don't think that community is an optional extra that you can take or leave depending upon your disposition. I don't care how manly man you are that the gospel calls you to live in community. It's calling you to the community of God's people as surely as it is calling you to Christ. That's how emphatic and integral it is. But then finally, let me just tell you, to set the tone for our next session, about a film. A film called Bobby. I don't know how many of you have seen it. It's a really fine, excellent film. It was made in 2006 by the director Emilio Estevez. And it's about the assassination in 1968 of Senator Robert F. Kennedy, who was, as you know, the president of John F. Kennedy, who was shot some 5 years earlier. And it is set on the night, the 5th of June, and in the hotel, the ambassador in L.A., in which the assassination took place. And it's a good story, very well told, and I recommend it. And one of the scenes involves a black chef named Edward Robinson. And he's played by Lawrence Fishburne. And he's talking to one of the waiters, a Mexican named Miguel. And they're arguing, these two men, as the staff eat a meal together in the kitchen. It's a time of racial tension. And the young Mexican is very angry at the injustice and the prejudice that he faces every day. And he cannot understand why the chef is so laid back. And he sees him as being compliant, and like some kind of Uncle Tom figure. But the chef responds, and this is what he says. "You know your problem, kid? You've got no poetry. You've got no light. You've got no one looking at you and saying, 'Damn, look at Miguel. I want some of what he got.'" Our life together as a people of God is a life of poetry and light created by the gospel. It's called to be an attractive, compelling, shared corporate life that others see and say, "Look at those Christians. I want some of what they got." And when we come back after the break, we're going to try and nail down how we create those kind of communities and what place they have within our life and discipleship. Have we got any questions? No, it doesn't look like we have at this stage. So we have got a 10-minute break, I think, coming up. It's longer than that now. But please be back here by 1:45. It is 1:45. Please be back here by 8:00. I'm not used to this technology. Really, you've got a couple of problems with me here this evening. One is I'm into kind of small church. So here you are, a big group. And that means that when I'm teaching, I like a bit of interaction. So that guy there who shouted out, you know, I'm actually going to give him a hug when I see him. Because he made me feel at home. Well, I'll wait to see what he looks like before I do. But so it is a bit. This is a bit kind of impersonal to me. I can just about make out your faces, and I really do. So that's a bit of a problem. And then secondly, some of you are watching me on screen, and I'm told that on camera, you know, you're 10 pounds bigger, and that's like a big problem with me. So I would advise you not to look at that, but to look straight at me. And you can be assured that in this recess that we've got, all the screens will be turned off in terms of my image, so you'll just be able to enjoy yourself and prepare yourself for having to come back and look at me again. So please be back promptly 8:00. Thank you.